This is Jim Inkster coming today on the show. We are slated to hear from Tommy Hodson, the LSU starting quarterback 1986 to 1989, still holds most of the records for passing in Tiger Town, and he'll be inducted in the Louisiana Sports Hall of Fame this weekend in Natchitoches, the pride of Matthews, Louisiana. Led the Tigers to SEC titles in 1986 and in 1988. Also, Jonathan Alter, formerly of Newsweek, the man who is one of the most profound followers of presidential politics and presidential history. He's written a biography about Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Now he has made Barack Obama, the current president, his target. We'll talk with Jonathan Alter about this and the historic week from the U.S. Supreme Court. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our numbers are 877-217-5757, and if you're dialing locally, 297-5633. Inkstershow at WRKF.org works if you're trying to reach us online. We begin with Tommy Hodson. 24 years after he threw his last pass at LSU, he still owns the record book for passing in Tiger Town. His career was a four-year march as a starter from 1986 to 1989, two SEC championships, 9,115 yards and 69 touchdowns, and come this weekend he will be inducted appropriately, perhaps overdue, in the Louisiana Sports Hall of Fame at Natchitoches. Good morning, Tommy Hodson.
Hey, good morning, Jim. Appreciate you having me.
Well, it doesn't seem like 24 years, does it?
No, it doesn't. Time flies, and I have twin daughters. They'll be entering LSU in the fall, so I'm getting older, for sure.
Yeah, that was more than half a lifetime ago for you.
Yeah.
I recall that you made your debut as a starter in the SEC your freshman year at the University of Florida, playing a fine Gator team, as they usually have fine teams there, and won. And that started a kind of a magical freshman season for you 27 years ago.
Yeah, I was fortunate that we had a veteran team. We had some older guys, and I fit in well with that team. We had good receivers, running backs, a great offensive line, and played good defense. And so it was great to be a part of that 86 team, and we won the Southeastern Conference Championship that year. So it was an extra special year.
Your coach was Bill Arnsparger. He seemed old at that time, but he actually was younger than Les Miles is, in fact, considerably younger than Miles is right now. So it's amazing how perceptions are at a certain age.
Well, he acted older. I guess he was a little more reserved and to himself, and Les is a little more charismatic, I guess. But Arnsparger was all business. He'd come from the Miami Dolphins and really treated us like professionals instead of college athletes. Didn't have a whole lot of rah-rah with him. But it was fun. I enjoyed learning how to prepare and practice and get ready for ball games underneath him, and I thought he did a super job of getting us all ready to play.
297-5633, if you'd like to pose a question to Thomas Paul Hodson, pride of Matthews, Louisiana, who started 4 years at LSU and passed for over 2,000 yards in each of his four seasons. At the time, he was only the third player in NCAA history to accomplish that feat. Number 13. Now, as far as memories during those 4 years, you had some magnificent games. I'm sure there's some times that stand out more than others.
Yeah, there's, of course, the Auburn LSU game in 88. A lot of people talk about it. It'd be 25 years since the earthquake game, and so that game kind of stands out. Texas A&M was my first start at home. That was a big game, and we won that game. And probably the biggest game, or the one I remember the most, is a win that we had in the Gator Bowl against South Carolina in 1987. And that 87 team was probably our best team. We didn't win the conference, but that was, I think, probably the best team I played on when I was there at LSU. So a lot of fond memories of that particular game.
That 87 team, people forget how good it really was. It was 10-1-1, the only loss coming to Alabama, and you didn't start that game.
That was the only game I didn't start in my career there, and but I did come in at the end. In all fairness, I threw two interceptions late. We lost to an Alabama team that I thought we were better than. We beat them in 86, and they were probably a little better than us in 86. What goes around comes around. They ended up beating us in 87, which was a real heartbreaker for us.
What an offensive line you had.
Yeah, super guys. Ruffin Rodriguez, Jim Hubitz, and then two guys that think of a lot, Eric Anisek, who passed away years ago, and then Ralph Norwood died also in an accident. Those two guys, and Nacho Albagamo, can't forget about him. Mm-hmm. Who's now Joe Albagamo here in town, Dr. Joe. So, great guys and great linemen.
Mm-hmm. And some people who were pretty outstanding at skill positions, too.
Yeah. All my friends teased me. They said, well, you weren't that good. Wendell Davis must have been 7 feet tall and vertical jump 40 inches to catch all those passes you threw to him. And when they meet him, he's just a regular guy, a normal guy. But, man, he could come out of the break and had tremendous separation out of the break and made it a lot easier for me to throw. And then Tony Moss as well, who was, undersized receiver. But, boy, he had some moves and broke a lot of people's ankles trying to tackle him.
Well, October 8th, 1988 is the game that Tommy, like it or not, will be most remembered for, and I'm sure he likes it. LSU beat a great Auburn team that night, a team that might have won the national title had the War Eagles not lost 7-6 to LSU, and LSU was down 6-0, just over a minute to go, and fourth down and 10 from the 11-yard line, the Auburn 11, and Tommy Hodson and lines his team up, and here's how it sounded almost 25 years ago.
LSU, fourth and 10 from the Auburn 11. Fourth down, 10 yards to go, 1:47 to go in the game. LSU wins or loses on this play, it would appear.
Now, seismograph near Tiger Stadium registered the outpouring of appreciation as an earthquake in magnitude. Do you remember it like that, Tommy?
No, I really don't. It gets loud in Tiger Stadium and often. And I think we're fortunate the guy left the machine on over the weekend, and we're able to record that thing and be a part of LSU folklore. Eddie and I are appreciative, and all our teammates appreciative, just to be a part of that play and one of the great plays at Tiger Stadium.
You played 6 years in the NFL for four different teams. How was your experience in that league?
Well, I didn't have as much success, obviously. I got drafted to the New England Patriots and spent my first 3 years there. We won 9 games in 3 years, so that's not a lot of games. So eventually everybody gets fired on a team like that, and I was no exception. So I bounced around and ended up playing with the Dolphins, Cowboys for a game, Dolphins for a little bit, and then the Saints the last 2 years, which was a lot of fun because I grew up a Saints fan. And I commuted, actually, from Baton Rouge to New Orleans every day. So it was a good time and a lot of fond memories, and met a lot of great people in the NFL, and still have a lot of friends from my playing days.
Well, the playing days are hard to top as far as emotion and attention, but you've had a successful life since then.
Well, I've been blessed. I have a great wife I have twin daughters. They're 18, and like I said, they're going to enter LSU in the fall. And went to St. Joe's Academy. They got great friends, and the community has been great to me. My business is good, and I couldn't be happier with Baton Rouge. I love being here, and the people sure are great to me.
Is it hard to come down after being on such a high? Not many of us have 80 or 90,000 people cheering the tops of their lungs on a given night.
It can be at times, I guess, but I've been fortunate. My parents, school teachers, my dad was a coach, and they always really raised me, hey, look, this is going to end sometimes. You got to have a fallback plan, something else to do, and you got to be able to walk away and enjoy it, but you got to be able to move forward and do something else. And they've always instilled that in me, so I think I've done okay just moving on.
Bill asked about the experience of playing for Mike Archer when he was hired after Bill Arnsparger hightailed it to Florida. Archer was the youngest coach in America. He was the coach on that 10-1-1 team, and then was the coach for the SEC championship a year later, and then things didn't go so well after that. But how was that experience?
Yeah. I enjoyed it. Coach Archer tried to keep the same kind of program going, and we had a lot of young coaches on that team, and a lot of coaches on that team are still coaching, and they were interested in moving up the ladder, I think, and sometimes back in those days, and like today, you have to recruit to stay good. And I think a lot of those young coaches were more interested in moving up the ladder than actually going out and developing the talent. So we had a lack of talent there at the end of my career, and then through the 90s, obviously, it was bad going. And but that's what it's all about, recruit the best players and getting them in, and you got to have people dedicated, committed to doing that.
Do you still follow the program?
I follow it from far away. I watch the games on TV, and I can't say I'm a fanatic about it, but I do. I watch the games, and I pull for them. Obviously, they're my best team, favorite team.
Yeah.
And I try not to get in the way. When I was a player, I was like, "What are these old guys still hanging around for?" So I never wanted to be one of those guys. I like to, like I said, move on, you know.
Yeah. There have been some good quarterbacks since you. In fact, some who were more than good, but none has broken the records of Tommy Hodson for career passing. How would you assess the people who have followed you at that position at LSU, Tommy?
Well, there have been some great players, and Herb Tyler. Herb Tyler was a very good quarterback. He wasn't a thrower, though, so he wasn't going to break passing records. But he was a good quarterback, and he had a lot of wins when he was there. If you look at Rohan Davey, I think that was his senior season. He threw for over 3,000 yards. I mean, that was to me, the greatest single season the quarterback's ever had at LSU. And that was my most enjoyable team to watch because they threw it around so well. Josh Reed caught a lot of balls. So there have been some good guys that have come through there, but they just hadn't. I played all 4 years and got to throw a lot of passes in 4 years, and a lot of the guys that have come behind me hadn't gotten that amount of time. And it's probably a pretty good tribute to the program because there's so many good players that play at LSU now. It would be hard for a quarterback to come in as a freshman or sophomore because LSU recruits nationally and recruits very talented kids. So it's just kind of the way it worked out. But there'll be somebody in the next probably 5-10 years that gets up there and starts for 3 or 4 years and breaks the record.
Who are you recruited by other than LSU?
I was recruited by Stanford, Michigan, and Tulane in football. And then I had a lot of small offers to play basketball, which I really wanted to. I was thinking about playing basketball always. Like, that was my first love. And really, that's the way we all grew up. My dad was a basketball player and basketball coach. But as time went on, I kind of caught the football fever, and then when LSU recruited me, it was kind of over once I made my visit here.
Well, congratulations, Tommy Hodson, who will be inducted in the Louisiana Sports Hall of Fame this weekend with some former LSU luminaries like Shaquille O'Neal and Kevin Mawai. Good to visit with you, Tommy.
Hey, thank you for having me. Appreciate
Take care.
It.
Bye-bye. We'll be back. Jonathan Alter is next on WRKM. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF. 297-5633 is your number. 877-217-5757. And you may reach us by email at inkstershow@wrkf.org. We're joined by Jonathan Alter, a prolific writer about American politics and American people. We've had him on the show a few times in the past, and his biographical targets have included Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and now he is taking another look, and a close one at that, at President Barack Obama. Good morning, Jonathan.
Good morning, Jim.
Well, as far as this president and what's going on right now, you've taken another look at him, and he's an interesting man, isn't he?
He is. You know, this book is about President Obama, but it's also about his enemies and about the momentous events of the last couple of years, excuse me, that we've all just been through together. And what I tried to do in The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies, as I call the book, is to pull back the curtain, tell people what was actually going on, not just inside the White House and you know, the Situation Room when they got bin Laden, and inside the Obama campaign headquarters in Chicago and his hotel suite on election night, what was going on in Boston in the high command of the Romney campaign, and what was going on behind closed doors when, say, Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch and Rush Limbaugh were trying to figure out who should run against Obama.
Well, they got Mitt Romney. Was that the candidate Obama wanted?
You know, I think it by the end it was. Actually, even early on, I think they figured out a way to run against him. They needed to go after his strength, which was his business experience. So that's why they really went hammer and tong on Bain Capital. There was even a point where they thought that he would be easier to face than Rick Santorum, who seemed to have more appeal among middle-class voters than Romney did, although Santorum obviously had his own weaknesses. But pretty much all along, they thought that they could handle Romney. But it's also important to understand that the deck looked like it was stacked against Obama. Even just a year before the election, many, many prognosticators thought that Obama was going to lose. And we tend to forget that now as we look back on this period. And one of the things that I also wanted to convey was just how high the stakes were. So whatever one's shortcomings, misgivings about the president right now and criticism of him, and I certainly, you know, share some of it, what everyone thinks about him now, it's a useful thought experiment to consider where the country would be right now if Romney and Ryan had been elected and we were living in a much, much more conservative country. This is not your father's Republican Party, as I think a lot of people understand. And if they had been validated and vindicated by the presidential election, we would be living in, as I said, a different, we'd be in a very different place right now. Not only would we not be debating immigration reform, but we would be probably living under the Ryan plan, which didn't just trim government, it slashed it very deeply, 50, 60, 70% reductions in programs, if not eliminated entirely. Programs that are quite popular, but they would have had the votes to get that plan through, and now it's a fantasy. So I wanted to explain to people, you know, both some of the mechanics of how Obama won, what happened inside what they called the cave, which was where the analytics geeks hung out in the Chicago headquarters, and how they helped people on the ground, the volunteers, the 2 million Obama volunteers on the ground, how they made their operation much more efficient. I wanted to explain that, but also kind of go a little bit more historical and provide the historical context and the comparisons to earlier elections and earlier political developments to give people a sense of just how momentous this was. Obama himself believed it was a much more important election than 2008.
297-5633 to visit with Jonathan Alter, the man who was a senior editor for Newsweek, worked there from 1983 to 2011, and has written three New York Times best-selling books about American presidents. We've talked with him about the other two, The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope, The Promise, and now The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. Now, Romney was thought to be the most moderate of the Republicans vying for the White House. He did choose an extremely conservative vice presidential candidate to be on the ticket with him. Why do you think that he would have governed more like Paul Ryan than, say, the old Mitt Romney, who was governor of Massachusetts?
Well, you know, when he was in Massachusetts, he had a very liberal state legislature that he had to deal with. In this case, he would have been dealing with a very conservative House of Representatives and, if things had gone the way people expected at the beginning of the year, a Republican, a Republican Senate as well. If he had moved too far to the center, he would have been a president without a party, which would have been impossible for him. He would not have moved away from the base. And the evidence of that is that during the campaign, when he had the most incentive to move to the center, because that's where the country is, largely in the center. And he had a great incentive to do that, to show that he was not the captive of the conservative base. He never did it. He did not criticize, people like Rush Limbaugh when they were calling a young woman student from Georgetown a slut. Anytime he had an opportunity try to put a little distance between himself and the base to show that he was a man of the middle and of moderate sensibilities, he basically bypassed that opportunity until the very end of the campaign. In that first debate, he began to repudiate some of his positions a little bit, because by that time it was too late for the base to get angry with him, because they smelled, they smelled power and victory. But I think he, a hard look at his record would show that, having flip-flopped from more moderate positions to much more conservative positions in order to get the nomination, it would have been very difficult for him to tack back to the center. And it's not at all clear that that's where his heart was. I think he was actually trying to seem more moderate when he was running in Massachusetts, and he's really quite conservative.
Well, the final tally, Obama, 65,899,660 votes, almost exactly 5 million ahead of Mitt Romney. It was not a particularly close election, 332 to 206 in the Electoral College. Obama carried more states, 26 to 24, and got the District of Columbia. But on Election Day, Romney, if legend has it right, he only had one speech, a victory speech, ready.
That's right, yeah.
So how could he be so off base not to know that he was in trouble?
Well, this is a story that I have some fun with in The Center Holds. They were in a bubble, and the night before the election, Paul Ryan is saying to his aides that the only thing that he's thinking about is, will he have to resign his seat in the House immediately upon becoming vice president-elect? And the other, they didn't really consider that they might lose. And the reason is that their polling operation and the echo chamber on Fox News and the rest of the conservative media, even people like George Will, were saying they were going to win 300 electoral votes. And that's part of the story, is that we were kind of living in these two different Americas, looking at the same country from two different ends of the telescope. And it turned out that the Democrats had a much, much clearer picture of where the American public really was. And I think that the Republicans assumed wrongly, as did many pollsters like Gallup, that white voters would turn out in greater numbers than they had in the past, even though the percentage of the electorate that's white had been shrinking almost like clockwork every 4 years by a couple of percentage points. And, of course, the percentage of the electorate that's Latino had been increasing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I have some, you know, part of a chapter in the book about just how did Obama get 73% of the Latino vote? And, you know, he did all kinds of things under the radar that the Anglo media, people like you and me, missed, included getting the Latina Oprah, a woman named Christina Saralegue from Univision, to make ads with Michelle Obama, going to soccer matches and naturalization ceremonies very quietly so that they wouldn't get embarrassed by doing that during the campaign, but all kinds of things that were not in the newspapers, not on radio and television, that took place during that campaign that helped explain the Obama victory. And, you know, the most significant of which was the what I call the geek gap between Obama and Romney, who was a self-described numbers guy, but just got lapped by Obama on the use of digital technology. And I think people understand that that happened. I try to explain in my book how it happened. How was it that these geeks in the cave, which included not just data scientists, but they had a biophysicist and three professional poker players and a child prodigy. And it's a very colorful story how they put together the analytics to re-engineer American politics.
Well, Nate Silver had it right, or pretty close to it, although I don't know that he thought it was going to be a 5 million vote gap. By the end,
he got it right. But, you know, a year out, he said that if conditions didn't change, that Obama had a 17% chance of winning. And the headline on his story in the New York Times was, "Is Obama toast?" So we tend to forget that this ended up, as he's saying, not being a particularly close election at the end, but there was a long period of time where it looked like Barack Obama would be a one-term president, a fluke, and as he said, if he lost, a footnote to history.
297-5633. We'll go to the phone lines in just a moment. Please be brief for Jonathan Alter. His latest work, another compelling one, The Center Holds, about President Obama. Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on with Jonathan.
Yes, as I recall it, the Republicans' own numbers geek, Karl Rove, seemed befuddled on election night that they really thought they were going to win, but something went wrong for them.
Yeah, I have that whole story and the way, he was out there embarrassing himself to the delight of Democrats on Fox on election night. And finally, Roger Ailes called the control room and had the anchor, Megyn Kelly, walk down the hall to the own Fox numbers crunchers who confirmed that Obama had won the election. Meanwhile, Fox had called it for Obama sometime before Rove's appearance, and that was when Obama knew that he had won. I have a little scene at the Fairmont Hotel where the Obama family was had their election night party, and at 12 minutes after 11 on election night, NBC News called it for the president, and Valerie Jarrett, his longtime aide, said, "You won," and the president said, "I'll believe it when I hear it on Fox." I tried to give people a sense of what was going on when there were no cameras. Another story that I tell is after that disastrous first debate, and I explain how in the mock debates, in the debate prep, the president was 0-for-6.
Yeah.
John Kerry playing Mitt Romney, and there are all sorts of reasons why he did badly in that debate that go back to that disastrous prep. Afterward, the president said to a friend, "You know that video where Samuel L. Jackson goes into the people's house and says, 'Wake the F up, wake the F up.' It went viral. And the president said, I didn't realize he was talking to me. You know, I think he understood that he had to get his act together in the second and third debates, and he did.
Well, you note that even though he went 0-6 against John Kerry, who was playing Mitt Romney, he made some statement like, I'm a game day kind of guy, and it didn't turn
right,
out.
Right, I'm a game day player, yeah. And his aides, his coaches, you know, hoped that was the case, but almost all of them, if not all of them, believed that he would lose that first debate, as he went on to do.
The center holds, Obama and his enemies, from Jonathan Alter. Tracy asked, does Obama have contempt for his enemies?
You know, that's a really great question. I think he does to a certain extent, and he can't express it in public because he knows that would just give aid and comfort to those enemies. He doesn't call them enemies. He reserves that for Al-Qaeda. But he does have some disdain and contempt for them. And actually, one of the things that hurt him in the debate prep was that he kept showing that disdain for Romney that he had, and his aides didn't want him to let that out. And you know, when it comes to other critics, like at one point Mike Huckabee gave a speech or appeared on television, I guess, and said that the president had been born in Kenya and raised learning about anti-colonial views of Kenyans, and an aide came and said, Governor Huckabee said that he misspoke, and Obama said, no, he didn't. He knew exactly what he was saying. He knew exactly what he was doing. He knew exactly what he was spreading, very coldly. And then another time when he came from a rally of Latinos where they had been talking about the DREAM Act, and some Republicans went on television to criticize, you know, the DREAM Act, which they'd blocked, and he just said, how can they be against these kids? These kids have done nothing wrong. They were brought here when they were 2 years old, through no fault of their own. They worked hard. They went to college. Who are they to be treating them this way? It just disgusted him. And so I think in answer to the question that, yes, he does have disdain and disgust for many of the critics, but he can't express it. And one final little story. Some of you might remember the Donald Trump's offer to him, if millions, if he turned in his transcripts, which was just a racist way of saying he hadn't been a good student, which was untrue, and his birth certificate, which he'd already turned over. And then Stephen Colbert said he'd make his own offer to Trump, which some of you might have seen on television is probably a little too off-color to say on the radio, but it was quite funny on Colbert's program. And then Obama met Colbert and said, I liked your offer to Trump.
All right, hold tight. We'll be back in 90 seconds with Jonathan Alter. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A few more minutes with Jonathan Alter, who has written his third presidential biography, the second about President Obama. This one, The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. As we hit the break, Jonathan, you were talking about the Stephen Colbert situation.
Well, it's just funny. Colbert made this off-color offer to Donald Trump to get him to shut up. And when he met the Obamas at the Kennedy Center Honors, Obama said, he brought up the Trump thing. And then Michelle Obama came racing over from the other side of the room and said, we watched that video over and over again of Colbert trashing Trump. So you get this impression of them in the White House, you know, secretly enjoying when other people would lash out at their critics. He did have disdain for African-American critics who said he wasn't black enough. And I have quite a bit in the book about his relations with other African-Americans in private. He was especially offended by Cornel West, the now former Princeton professor. And he came down from a speech at the National Urban League and saw West in the front row and cursed him out for saying that he wasn't progressive and wasn't black enough and was a lackey of Wall Street. And then later at a meeting with Al Sharpton and more supportive black leaders, the subject came up of, you know, do you have a black agenda? And the president said, well, just because I don't say black, 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 doesn't mean that my agenda is not pro-black. And if I said it was pro-black, it wouldn't have gone through. So, and most of the people in the room, the civil rights leaders, African-American leaders and media figures, agreed with that and did support him very, very strongly throughout the campaign. So people like Al Sharpton and Michael Eric Dyson and others cooperated on my book, and I think the Center Holds is richer for the fact that I have these, you know, inside the room conversations between the president and not just his aides, but black leaders and Latino leaders and others in the Obama coalition.
Did want to ask you, and a few listeners have asked me to, the Supreme Court, of course, yesterday made a couple of historic decisions on same-sex marriage. This issue was a factor, perhaps not as big as some thought it would be, in the 2012 presidential election when Joe Biden and President Obama came forward and announced their support for same-sex marriage. Your thoughts about the issue in the campaign of last year, and were you surprised at the Supreme Court decisions?
Well, I wasn't surprised because the you know, the advance word was things were moving that way. The president made a very important decision that paved the way for that decision, which was the government decided not to defend DOMA anymore in court, and that had been signed under Bill Clinton. But when the Obama administration made that decision a couple of years ago, it made the outcome in the Supreme Court more likely. I was more surprised and disturbed by the decision in the Voting Rights Act case. I have a chapter in my book called The Voter Suppression Project, in which I explain that there was a concerted effort in 19 states to pass legislation, which was approved in 19 states in 2011 and 2012, that if it had stayed on the books, would have made it very difficult for the president to be reelected. And these voter suppression bills were overturned by judges and otherwise blocked, and that allowed Obama to win. So there was a real effort to depress turnout among black students and other parts of the Democratic coalition. It was intentional. It was done under the cover of alleged vote fraud, but there was very, very little, if any, evidence of vote fraud that was introduced in court. And this was a highly partisan struggle. And unfortunately, the decision by the Supreme Court earlier this week will make it easier for states to move forward with voter suppression bills, which is very disturbing and moving in the wrong direction for this country, not just in the South, but throughout the United States. There are efforts to try to target Democratic constituency groups because Republicans prosper when fewer people vote. Democrats prosper when more people vote.
Dorothy in Goodwood, you'll be the last caller for Jonathan. Please be brief, Dorothy.
Yes, I was a core team leader with the Obama campaign. And, pardon me, my dogs have a lot to say about.
What's your question, Dorothy? What's your question?
Yes, my comment was we knew exactly who to target, when to target, and how to target.
All right. She says they knew who to target, when to target, and how to target.
Exactly. So, Dorothy, what I do is I tell your story and the story of anybody else out there who worked on the Obama campaign and the way the technology worked with the shoe leather so that volunteers and other Obama supporters could work much more efficiently in knowing who and when and where to target, and then I contrast that to the way the Romney campaign was really running what Romney called a Mad Men campaign out of the 1980s. And the difference was huge, and it allowed people like Dorothy to make much better use of their time on the ground in helping to reelect the president and change history.
Well, Jonathan, congratulations on another fine book, The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies, a new look and certainly a groundbreaking look at the 2012 campaign. Yeah, I'm sure as a kid you read the old Theodore White books.
I loved those books, and this book is written in that spirit.
It is indeed, and it is. I think the definitive book to date on what happened a year ago. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thanks so much, Jim.
Take care. Bye-bye. And tomorrow on the program, we will talk more about the Supreme Court decisions from yesterday. Today's pages and all newspapers across the land are filled with front-page news about the high court's actions. And the New York Times put it this way: when proponents of same-sex marriage decided nearly 5 years ago to bring their legal battle before the Supreme Court, the decision set off a spasm of anxiety among many gay leaders worried that an adverse ruling would set back a fight that many of them had never really wanted. Well, the fight was won in a 5-4 vote, and right now the rulings of yesterday leave in place laws banning same-sex marriage around the nation. And the court did decline to say whether there was a constitutional right to such unions, but it cleared the way for same-sex marriage in California, the nation's most populous state, effectively increasing to 13 the number of states that allow it. A pair of major victories for the gay rights movement from the U.S. Supreme Court on 5-4 decisions, and we will talk more about this tomorrow. And it will be interesting to see if any Louisiana lawmaker, any of the 144, has an inclination to go forward with legislation that would permit same-sex marriages in Louisiana. We shall see. And we will, of course, invite your participation in our conversation tomorrow. Now, for those of us who watch Louisiana Public Broadcasting, one of the mainstays is the Antiques Roadshow. And there is a nationwide tour of the Antiques Roadshow going on in places like Detroit, Jacksonville, Anaheim, Boise, Knoxville, Kansas City, Richmond, and Baton Rouge. And we'll talk about the event coming here next month. But Kate Bradshaw, the special events coordinator with LPB, is with us in our final moments this hour. The Antiques Roadshow, it's a big part of the staple of fine programming on LPB.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. It's PBS's highest rated ongoing series, and it will be coming to Baton Rouge this summer, July 27th. It'll be taking over the River Center. It's truly an exciting event that we will be hosting here in the capital state city. So we're really, really looking forward to it. It's an 8-city summer tour. It's the kickoff for season 18, which will air in 2014. 6,000 tickets were given out. Over 10 to 12,000 items will be appraised that day. It's really a well-oiled machine that they have.
All right, so that's a month from today, and it'll be quite an event. I would doubt that they just show up on the 26th and say, let's have a party. There has to be some preparation.
No, they show up a few days actually before, and they bring in crews. Some of the crews here work on it, and they really put together an entire set. It's amazing. I've watched some of the behind-the-scenes shows, and it's amazing really what they do to get this all together and get these people moved through in the matter of 8 hours. So it's going to be a really, mm-hmm. really great event, and we have partnered with Visit Baton Rouge, and we are going to host an Antiques Roadshow VIP Summer Social Friday, the night before. It's kind of going to be a kickoff celebration to the next day. This is an opportunity for fans of the show.
And where will that be?
That will be at the Old State Capitol at 7 p.m. It's an opportunity for people to meet Mark Wahlberg, the host of the show, the executive producer and the appraisers. Really a chance for you to pick their brains and to understand how this all works. So it's going to be a great night, a lot of fun. The Michael Foster Project will be playing. We'll have a great buffet provided by Heirloom Cuisine. And so we are selling tickets for that event right now. We hope that everybody will, you know, come and join us and really be a part of this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity here in Baton Rouge.
297-5633 in our remaining time with Kate Bradshaw, the Special Events Coordinator for Louisiana Public Broadcasting. Now, a listener, it is Marie. She says that the tickets are not available at the door for the event on the 27th.
That is correct.
The application has passed, so is there any way for people to participate in that event who are not ticketed right now?
We still have a few tickets left for the event. You can go online to lpb.org to find out more information or contact us at our offices. All of the tickets that were given out in the lottery, which was 6,000, that has closed. So those are no longer available. We have a few. And we're really, really looking forward to such a great event on Friday night and allowing people to really come in and meet the appraiser. So if you didn't get a chance to go to Antiques Roadshow, this is still your chance to be a part of such an exciting event.
LPB.org is a place to go. How do you explain the popularity of this show? It's one that certainly has stood the test of time.
Absolutely. It's become a part of American history, really. It's everybody from all ages loves to tune in to see what is going to happen. What are they going to discover? What's going to show up next? I think that's truly the exciting part of it. It's a mystery. You don't know what you have or what you're going to show up with and the value.
Well, the Antiques Roadshow is how many years old now, Kate?
They are going into their 18th season.
18 years. So we're going back to the mid-90s.
Mm-hmm.
When William Jefferson Clinton was president of the United States, and we had George Bush, we had Barack Obama, we had Mike Foster, who's governor. By the way, he was not the head of the Michael Foster Project. He'll be performing on Friday at the old state capitol on the 26th. But we've had a lot of changes through those years, and yet people still flock for this show. All over the country, and when you look at the tour, they're places representing almost every region of the country. This isn't the first tour they've had either, is it?
No, it's not. They were in Louisiana in 2002 in New Orleans, and I know the president of Visit Baton Rouge and the mayor have really been pushing for them to come here, and they finally, the accumulation of all their efforts has really finally gotten them here, so we're really excited.
It's Paul Arrigo, right?
He's very
happy, and the old state capitol is a good venue for this sort of thing.
Absolutely.
So it'll be on the 26th. LPP.org, and then Saturday the 27th, the big event at the Baton Rouge River Center, Exhibition Halls 1 and 2. How big will it be?
They get 6,000 people through, 10,000 to 12,000 items. There's about 70 appraisers, and they take over almost the entire River Center, conference areas and the big arena. So it's truly an interesting way they get everybody through this in that amount of time. It's going to be very exciting.
And it's quite an honor that they're coming to Baton Rouge.
Yes, definitely.
So it's an opportunity for those who are fans of this show to participate, but the seating is quite limited, or the space is quite limited, for those who wish to take part on the 27th. So this is the time, if you want to get there and be there, be a part of it, to take action.
Absolutely. And like I said, if you can't get there for the 27th, please come out on the 26th and meet the appraisers and the host. It's truly a chance for you to pick their brains and understand a little bit more how this happens. I know it always blows my mind how much these appraisers know. They're just a wealth of knowledge about so many different items, and they come here, and you never know what you're going to discover.
Where are they
discover.
From?
All over the country. They pull the best appraisers from all over the country, and they bring them in, and they volunteer for this, which is really great.
Well, the Antiques Roadshow, 18 years on the air, and come July 26th and July 27th, the group, how many people will be coming from that program?
about 70 appraisers, the hosts, the executive producers, their crew. So we're going to have a lot of people here in Baton Rouge.
It sounds like it. And I'm sure Kate Bradshaw will be there.
Yes,
I will.
Might
even see Beth Courtney in the crowd, right?
Definitely.
I would think so. Quite an event from Louisiana Public Broadcasting featuring the Antiques Roadshow. And there will be a two-week gap, as there are for all of these events, as I look at least moving forward. They stop the 13th of July in Knoxville, and then it's the 27th right here in Baton Rouge. The last two will be in Kansas City and in Richmond in August. So thank you, and good luck.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, everybody. For Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.